Good afternoon. So I'm going to talk about the second, what I consider to be the second most important galaxy property, galaxy size, and its connection to the halo properties, in particular focusing on the radius, virial radius, which for the purpose of this talk will be defined as radius enclosing density contrast of 200 with respect to critical density. But before I do that, let me spend a few minutes talking about correlation between those first two most important properties, the size and stellar mass. It's a well-known correlation, but it does hold some interesting features and surprises. And also, it will help me to orient you when I'm going to be talking about the connection of size to the halo radius. So size and stellar mass, it's well known that they're correlated. They're independent quantities, but they exhibit pretty tight correlation. And this correlation is not subtle. It's something that you see easily in this diagram, which shows the random drawing of galaxies ranked in stellar mass, in logarithm of stellar mass increasing here from left to right, from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 12 stellar masses. And each column shows just random drawing of some number of galaxies in a stellar mass bin, and each column steps in constant d log m star. So what you are seeing here is essentially a correlation of size as a function of log m star, and the size is, can be compared across the horizontal row because each thumbnail shows you the same physical size, 30 kiloparsec. And so you see that as you increase the stellar mass, the galaxies increase in extent, they fill the aperture at the highest masses, and so you see this correlation visually. This is a random drawing from the entire galaxy population, so you see it's a mix of late-type galaxies dominating at low stellar masses and early-type galaxies dominating high stellar masses, but you see a mix of different morphologies. But the same basic trend persists if you just look at elliptical galaxies, so here's the same type of random drawing as a function of stellar mass, but only selecting elliptical galaxies, spheroidal galaxies, and the same, you can see the trend here. And only if you select late-type galaxies, the same thing here. So you see this basic trend visually, but you can actually see more of the trend if you observe, by watching. Following the wisdom of Yogi Berra, you can observe a lot just by watching, by paying attention to these diagrams. Who is Yogi Berra? For those of you who don't know, he's a treasure trove of wisdom. And if you want to know more, I refer you to my co-organizer, Andrew Zentner, who taught me everything I know about Yogi Berra. So let's follow his advice and look at this diagram, and I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you a chance to tell me what second salient feature in the size stellar mass correlation you can observe by watching this diagram carefully, in addition to just overall increase of size with stellar mass. What about bulge? Oh, there are lots of trends. There are experts here in the audience, so there's lots of trends that people can pick up. But actually, the trend that I want to notice is a trend related to the size. So the overall size increase with stellar mass that you can see clearly in this diagram, and your eye is drawn to this overall gradient, if you actually split this diagram in two, which is roughly L star, so this goes from 10 to 9 to 10 to 12, L star is in the middle, and if you just look to the left, you can see that here the increase of size of stellar mass is very mild. The size doesn't change very much. Whereas if you go to the right, the size jumps almost instantly. It increases very rapidly. So you see visually that the galaxy correlation between size and logarithm of stellar mass is not a simple linear function. It's a weak dependence at low stellar masses and much stronger dependence at high stellar masses. And this change occurs roughly at L star for L star galaxies. So if you look at, if you actually quantify this and look at the catalog. So this is Sloan Digital Sky Survey with half-light radius of galaxies shown as a function of stellar mass. It's a Sloan Digital Sky Survey galaxies, but the quantities that you see here, the stellar mass and the size, were derived from the remeasurements of the photometry by Mariangela Bernardi's group, which was published in a catalog a couple of years ago, which is publicly available. So you can make this plot tonight if you want to prove me wrong, or I can show you how to do it. And the reason I'm using not the standard Sloan photometry, but this catalog, because I think they did a much better job in measuring both the stellar masses and sizes, which is important to get these correlations right. So what you see is the distribution of galaxies at redshift less than 0.1 is the SS. The histogram shows just all galaxies, the way they're distributed in this plane. The magenta line is their median. And the blue and red are the size Telemach relation for disks and elliptical galaxies separately. So one nice complement of this catalog is that it includes probabilities, morphological probabilities for each galaxy. So there is a probability for a galaxy to be elliptical, S0, SCD, AB, and they can be combined into classical morphological type T, which you can use to split galaxies in morphology. So basically, the high numbers correspond to late-type galaxies, large negative numbers correspond to spheroidal elliptical galaxies. So the red and blue lines here are corresponding to those splits in T. And of course, you know, those of you who are not familiar with T, it may not make much sense, but really, to show you that this split does work, here is a random drawing of galaxies split with a threshold of 4 as a function of stellar mass, and you can see that it selects these galaxies at all masses. So not selecting on surgic index concentration, whatever, it really selects these galaxies, these galaxies of disk morphology. If you look at the cut and T minus 3, it's all spheroidal galaxies. So when you look at the size stellar mass relation here, these two different lines, they really correspond to disks and ellipticals. And one surprising thing for me was to see that how close these relations are. So first of all, they're more or less parallel. And second, the shift of them, there is a noticeable difference, but it's not that huge. Moreover, you can notice that this difference is partly artificial because we're looking at these galaxies just randomly oriented, where size is corrected for inclination, but spheroidal galaxies have spheroidal mass distribution, and their mass distribution, therefore, is subject to geometric effect, which makes them appear more compact, simply because near the center of the galaxy, you go through a larger column and so pick up larger mass of stars within a given radius, and that appears, this overweighs the center relative to the outskirts, well-known geometric effect, and therefore they appear to be more compact than they would be if you could measure this radius in three dimensions. So of course we're interested physically in the three-dimensional radius because that's a physical coordinate projection, it's just projection effect. And so to compare disks and spheroids on a sort of equal footing, we have to deproject the size for spheroidal galaxies, and that's what's done here in this plot, where I apply correction, which is well known for the galaxy, spheroidal galaxy's surgic profile. In this case, for the catalog, each galaxy has a surgic index, so we can apply this correction individually and convert the 2D radius into 3D radius. After this correction, the difference almost completely disappears. So now I find it surprising. I don't know how many people in the room find it surprising because I had the impression that elliptical galaxies are more compact. Well, according to the data, they're not. It's like, at least not at redshift zero. And they follow more or less a similar size stellar mass relation. Okay? So that's the first surprising thing. And if you're surprised, ask me afterwards and let's discuss this. To orient yourself, so we are here. This is the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is a little bit below these median relations, as was pointed out by Aliqui and Jeff Newman, who is in the audience, but not too far. Essentially, it looks like a pretty common galaxy. Even for these galaxies, it's well within one sigma, or maybe close to one sigma, but it's not very far from the median. What's more surprising, even maybe the BCGs, the brightest cluster galaxies, these are points from the study we did with Alexei Vikhlin and his student, in 2014, where these are 3D radii measured from light distribution in 9 nearby clusters for brightest cluster galaxies, and they lie essentially on the extension of this relation. But it's kind of strange to think that the disks, the largest disks in the sample, at this very large stellar masses, there are disks like this, there are 10 to the 12 stellar mass disks, they actually have sizes that are comparable to the BCG galaxies. That to me was also quite striking. Okay, so coming back to the original goal to explore the connection between the size and the halo. So far we've been just looking at things that are derived from observations and finding some surprising stuff. But when you look at the halo connection, which we can explore by converting the stellar mass to halo mass using the well-known stellar mass-halo mass relation we discussed here already quite a bit. This relation now is quite well established, both from theoretical expectations, from the fact that the abundance matching model seemed to work, which can allow us to generate lines like this by matching the halo mass function with the stellar mass function, so three different lines, essentially a result of matching the halo mass function in a Bolshoi simulation with the stellar mass function measurement from Bernardi et al., with different lines indicating the effect of scatter. And points in different bands are observational measurements. So we have now a good handle of this just for even from observations with no regard to abundance matching. So when we talk about using abundance matching for this conversion, it's true, it's formally true, but also you can view these lines as just the fitting lines that goes through the observational measurements. This is what data indicates the relation is for the galaxy within the central mass, the stellar mass of the central galaxy, and the halo mass within Tucholsky radius of corresponding to Tucholsky critical. Because this relation is quite steep at the high masses, which is steeper than the previous determinations of this relation, which go more like this, due to the increase of stellar masses by this photometry that Bernard et al. Have showed that should be there, that the outer skirts of galaxies contributing quite a bit to the luminosity of massive galaxies, the effect of scatter is not that significant. You can see that the difference between dotted line, which has no scatter, and the solid line is just maybe 0.1, 0.2 dex. That's in halo mass. If you go to halo radius, you have to divide this effect by three to get the effect on the halo radius of this connection. So in what follows, the scatter is neglected because it's small. So if we use the stellar mass halo mass relation and then use the one-to-one correspondence between the radius and halo mass in definitional correspondence, we can essentially substitute the variable. We can make a variable substitution for stellar mass and convert it into the halo radius to get the size halo radius relation. So very simple. So if we do that, we get this result. So it's the same galaxies plotted now as a function of R200 critical. So it's just a variable change, as I said. But you can see that this variable change eliminates all of the curvature in the relation, all of this visual trend that you saw in a gallery of thumbnail images is eliminated if the stellar mass is converted to the halo mass, and what you can see is just a linear, close to linear relation. The solid lines correspond again to the median for the entire sample and the medians for ellipticals and late types, and you can see that all of these medians more or less follow the same. They're all hugging the line that's called by dashed line, which is 0.02 R200 critical. Okay. Right. So the color is that the curvature that you see in the size stellar mass relation is all due to the curvature in the stellar mass halo mass relation. The size itself is a simple function of the halo mass or halo radius. It's just a parallel function, and in case of halo radius, it's just a linear function. And all the nonlinearities that we see in the size stellar mass relation is induced by stellar mass halo mass, nonlinear relation between stellar mass and halo mass. Okay, so this was something that we've seen I think in 2013, but for much more heterogeneous samples. So the reason for going into Sloan and doing it more carefully was essentially to check just how well this worked, how well characterized sample. But essentially, if you look at dwarf galaxies, you find something that's this relation that Sloan cannot probe still seems to extend even to dwarf galaxies. And for BCGs, I showed you that BCGs also seem to lie on the same relation, which is very surprising because those are very different types of galaxies. Ellipticals, disks, BCGs, they're all very different. Now, at high ratios, people have looked at this as well. There is recent work that we've heard from Rachel and we'll hear from Mike Fall after the coffee break. Essentially, the result is that at high ratios, when people do the same type of exercise, looking at the effective radius as a function of halo radius, they find a similar linear relation. In fact, you see here at different ratios the measurements for early type and disk types, and the solid line shows you the ratio zero relation, and it looks like it's a fit to the early type galaxies. It's fully consistent with early types, and the relation doesn't evolve very much with redshift. If you go all the way to redshift 2.5, you cannot measure slope very well here, but normalization at least doesn't seem to change that much. But what's different between high ratios and low ratios, which are the difference that I don't understand, I'm looking actually for input about ways to understand it, is that in this sample, there is a difference between late type and disk galaxies and normalization, something that I don't see at ratio below 0.1 in the Sloan galaxies. And actually, it's also true for gamma galaxies as well. Right, so there's some difference. And part of it could be due to the fact that it's still a projected distance, so it's not a deprojected distance, but the differences are too large. So deprojection gives a factor of about 1.4, whereas differences here are a factor of 2 to 3. So deprojection cannot be the entire story. It's something maybe with size measurement, or maybe it is a real difference between high ratios and low ratios, which would be very interesting. What about the scatter? So Rachel mentioned that the scatter is comparable but somewhat smaller in observed galaxies compared to the expectations. So here's a plot where you can see the same relation, the median relation, but now the band shows 68th percentile scatter at a fixed halo radius in the size of galaxies. This is shown just for the median sample, but the scatter for disk and elliptical galaxies is quite comparable. I didn't plot them not to overcrowd the plot, but they're essentially very similar to this shaded band that you see. The dashed lines are expectations of a simple model for the sizes that was developed by Fulmer, Stasiu, Blumenthal et al., and many, many others, and used extensively in models of galaxy formation, where size is set by specific angular momentum of material, baryonic material that comes in, that is assumed to be comparable to the angular momentum of dark matter. And then the size is set by conservation of angular momentum and by rotational support, where at the radius where the angular momentum is would be appropriate to have a given mass element on a circular orbit. So these usual angular momentum is usually parameterized in the language of dimensionless spin parameter, which is a quantity that's easy to understand. So this equation shows you how it's defined in the James Bullock's definition. It's a quantity that's dimensionless, which connects a specific angular momentum at 200 to what angular momentum would have to be in order for a mass element to be on a circular orbit at R200. So if lambda would be 1, it means that a material that comes in would immediately go into circular orbit at the virial radius. Of course, real matter doesn't have such large angular momentum. When it comes in, specific angular momentum is much smaller, so it sinks to the center. And it sinks by the amount that's proportional to the spin parameter. The final radius then is proportional to the virial radius times the spin parameter with this factor that's given by the ratio of rotation velocity, rotation circular velocity curve at 200 and R50. We know that circular velocity curves are quite flat, so this factor is almost mass independent because concentration is almost mass independent, and it's of order unity, right? So we know that the size should be of order of lambda times R200 critical. And also we know the scatter in this quantity is about 0.25 dex, so we can predict what the scatter should be here. You can see that the prediction is comparable to the galaxy scatter, but galaxy scatter is somewhat smaller. And the prediction does not include any sort of observational errors. So observational errors in size measurement and stellar measurement are not folded in. So the actual prediction should be actually wider than this. There may be interesting discrepancy in the size distribution and the standard expectations of this model. The model itself, of course, can be wrong, but at the same time, it gives us something close to what the median should be doing, but the scatter may tell us something about the process that sets this relation in detail. And what does it set this relation? So this simple picture seems to work in describing the median relation, but is this really all there is to it? And we know that if we look in simulation, that's not the only thing that there is to it, because when we look at what simulations tell us about the evolution of galaxies in this plane, and I'm using a randomly selected paper from the recent literature, which looked into this, but I also refer to you for a nice work by Sokolowska and Lütschemeyer, which on the same subject. This size in the plane of size virial relation of a Milky Way-sized galaxy that forms a nice late-type disk with a roughly correct size at redshift zero, it evolves along this linear relation at low at after about redshift of 2 or so. So it does do what the standard simple picture says, and it ends up in the right place in this relation. But we know that only happens if we choose parameters of star formation and feedback that make the feedback and outflows in this galaxy efficient. If we resimulate the same galaxy with somewhat different set of parameters, the galaxy goes compact and suffers from the standard problems that simulations of galaxy formation suffered a decade ago, where galaxies become compact, and once they become compact, they stay compact. So the physics that's included in this run is all the same physics that goes in the standard model, but without feedback, the galaxy cannot maintain the correct size. And once this problem appears, it's very difficult to undo. And so we know that in order to realize a simple picture, the feedback has to be efficient, because probably it helps to preserve the specific angular momentum. So if you get out one thing out of this talk, I hope that you get out the answer to this question about what do all of these galaxies have in common, late-type disks, BCGs, high-redshift galaxies in UDF. What they have in common is that their half-light radii are all about 2% of the virial radius, regardless of their morphological type. Are you surprised? I don't know. I was surprised when I saw it, and I think we still don't quite understand why it works so well for both elliptical galaxies and these galaxies. Thank you.
Questions?
Yep.
Yoyama, Pittsburgh. So if you instead using R200M or R200Crit, but use, say, scale radius or RVMAX, would that reduce the scatter in the size halo radius relation? Because most of the curvature coming from halo mass, stellar mass relation, right? But there are still, I mean, there are concentration dependence at a given halo mass. So I guess my question is the scatter that you see in the size halo mass relation can be further attributed to secondary halo property. And then also, I guess the scale radius is also closer to the core of the halo, so might be more physically related to the size of the galaxy.
I think it's a question for models. I don't think you can get it from this analysis because I don't know how to include the scale radius correction into the observational analysis, right? We don't know scale radii for galaxies.
Is the offset between basically red and blue galaxies at high redshift that you showed, that Rachel showed yesterday, is that offset too large to be explained within reason by differences in the stellar to halo mass relation for star forming and quench galaxies?
I don't know if it's, I don't know much about how this relation should be at those higher redshifts. What I can tell you is that at low redshift, the difference in stellar mass halo mass relation for red and blue galaxies that people have inferred so far is too small to make a difference. So in other words, I actually showed you a result with no correction for this, but this is the same plot, but with applying different relation for red and blue galaxies, and essentially you get some difference, but it's not too big. At high redshifts, I don't think we know well what the difference is. But the consequence, what you get out in this relation, of course, what goes into it is relation between stellar mass and halo mass. If you find significant difference for red and blue galaxies, then it will cause different. But in the study that was done by Rachel and Mike, they didn't use a different relation, they use the same. The Huang et al., they tried using different relation for red and blue, they didn't find that there's a huge difference. No, that by itself is not explaining it, unless it's much larger than we think.
So we know Sloan has some surface brightness selection, and of course we know that there are these ultra diffuse galaxies out there. We don't know maybe what their masses are specifically, but where would these lie in the stellar mass or the halo mass radius relation?
Right. So in terms for the first question, I chose to look only at masses where I don't think the sample suffers from surface brightness completeness, and also seen as well, so you have to worry about seen effects on the size. Ultra diffuse galaxies, I looked into this, not in great detail, but I looked quickly at this, and it looks to me like they are about 2 sigma outliers from the medium.
I am surprised that early types and late types fall on the same relation. I think it's rather intriguing. I understand maybe how this works for late types, which form out of the cooling gas, but what's your vision for how this works for the more massive galaxies, where their outskirts are supposed to be formed by depositing material, like disruption of small minor merges, in which case I would have thought it would be related to the orbits of those small halos, but also the masses of those small halos. So if they were smaller, you'd have a lot more mass deposited on the outskirts. So how does that work in this picture?
So I think it's an interesting question to address with models. My basic answer would be that those satellites that come in and form the outskirts, they also have angular momentum, right? And so if angular momentum is the answer, it will be the answer even if you accrete stars through mergers, as long as this angular momentum doesn't change very much as you go from, on average, as you go down, up and down in halo mass.
So, Surudhya.
Yeah.
So, Andre, I think the scaling that you tried to show from the predictions, it just tells you what the slope of this relation is, right, rather than the amplitude. So can you comment also about the amplitude?
So which relation?
The size R-Weir relation. When you said that there is a prediction, right?
That's true. So there are variants of the model where you actually do get the prediction for the amplitude, and this amplitude that we see is about half of that at redshift zero.
Where does the prediction come from? Because at least in low amount of light, it's just a free parameter.
Okay, yeah, so prediction comes if you set everything to some, you know, fiducial values and assume there is no contraction, there's no loss of angular momentum. Right. So that's, it's not a really
prediction.
Okay, there's no prediction.
Right.
Only about the slope.
Right. No, but then the question is, in the simulations you showed that basically if you don't get the feedback right, then you start moving away from this relation, right?
Yeah.
So the question is, does the scaling still hold, or it's just that you're offsetting the amplitude because of the feedback? So that
no, the scaling doesn't hold because what you're looking here is the same object as this. So it evolves along the same halo radius. But of course, this is not a linear relation, right? Mm-hmm. The size doesn't change while halo radius grows.
So you're saying basically throughout the evolution, it should stay on this?
At least at the redshifts where it's probed. Which is redshift between 3 and 0 now.
Sure, and how long is that track? So that was...
That track, this is redshift 3, and this is redshift 2 or so, and then this is 2 okay. to 1 to 0 here.
Where it fits, whether it's... It might, well, within the scatter here, it probably, so there's two orders of magnitude here.
Well, you don't have to move in the scatter, you have to get a median right within 10 seconds.
What I'm saying is it's a prediction, I don't know if the right prediction or not.
So, I am surprised.
Good, and I'm not the only one.
The no feedback kind of models, we understand angular momentum loss because of dynamical friction. You say feedback may help preserve the angular momentum. But I have a hard time picturing how it does. We have all this gas blowing out of the galaxy. It's plus, I thought, so I'm asking you, how does that work? And second, I thought that people looked at the residuals of these relations and how they correlate with halo properties, and that the simple models get those residual correlations wrong. I think Harry Desmond is here. I think he should comment maybe at first.
Well, so let me answer about the what I think is happening. So we went into explanation qualitatively in this paper, and what I think is happening is that the feedback essentially keeps the disk low mass. And as we know, the low mass disks, when they are not dominating gravity, they are more stable, right? And so if without feedback, the disk tends to grow too massive, it breaks up. And those break clumps into which they break up, they go into the center, lose angular momentum, and form a very dense clump, and they can be undone afterwards. And so what feedback does is that it keeps the disk fraction according to the standard stability criterion of Eustachio. You know, it keeps the mass fraction in the disk component low, and therefore preventing the violent breakup of the disk. So that was my understanding how it hit.
But you still have to blow out much more mass than you put in stars. And when you blow out that gas, it's going to shock and hit other gas. So yeah. Why would we conserve its angular momentum?
So this all of this is blowouts and very violent things that all happen here. I don't know if this is correct or not, but it does produce this galaxy in the end with the correct size. And there is most of the baryons end up in the halo and outside of the halo in this simulation. Yeah.
Let me ask a question. So if you take Illustrious or Eagle or one of these simulations, you can easily take the half-mass radius of the galaxy and divide it by the half-mass radius of its halo and plot that against lambda for the halo. So do you actually see a relation, or do you just get a complete scatter plot?
I would be very interested to see this. I didn't get to actually look at it. I mean, you can see we looked at it in our simulation. But
so if Harry can tell us.
So I've looked with Yope and the Eagle simulation for precisely this correlation. The answer is that size correlates very little with halo spin at fixed stellar mass.
Sorry, I can't hear.
Galaxy size correlates very little with halo spin at fixed stellar mass in the Eagle simulation.
But was halo spin measured at the same time?
Halo spin, this is all at redshift zero. Yeah, so that seems to sort of violate this basic prediction of the MoMAO white type model, where size is actually strongly dependent on halo spin. The other thing I'd like to comment on, as Yope was saying, is that there's another issue beside the scatter in the mass size relation from using this model, which is that it strongly anti-correlates the residuals of the mass size relation with the residuals of the Tully-Fisher relation, just due to a correlation between galaxy size and halo concentration, which the Mohmal-White model also imposes.
You're talking about models, not data.
Models. Well, yeah, so it predicts a strong anti-correlation, which isn't seen in the data.
Okay.
So I think that's another problem with this simple angular momentum partition type argument, over and above just the pure scattering sizes.
So I find it tantalizing because the relation is so simple and so close to this basic picture, and yet when you start thinking about it, it looks, certain details are different. Well, you mean some averaging, some statistical averaging. Doesn't give reasonable video radii.
Sure.
So I would love to see the Eagle prediction on this plane.
I have a couple of questions. One is R50 is relatively small compared to the scale of the galaxy. Did you get a similar result if you use like R90 or something that goes out to the edge? And the other is, there's a very tight correlation between the size of galaxies' H1 disks and their H1 mass, irrespective of the rotation velocity or halo mass. And there's a lot of scatter in gas mass at fixed halo mass, which seems, I don't see how that would. Could you just comment on that, I guess? I don't see how that works.
Yeah, so actually in a 2013 paper, I looked at gas profiles and gas sizes. So for galaxies of these masses, the gas fractions are small to change the size of the baryonic disk by a lot. So what you see in here is essentially the size of half mass radius of the baryonic disk. With respect to R90, I expect it to be, for a given surgic profile, to just be proportional to R50. So I don't think there'll be much difference. And
systematically changes with stellar mass, so it should change a little bit. Slope should change at least.
Okay, but it's easy to look at. Sure, yeah.
Well, not a question, just a comment. Just adding to the curiosity of this, I mean, as you know, a lot of the discussion is framed in terms of spin, and you showed the Milky Way simulation there, and you can make sort of arguments, but as you showed, this is true regardless of whether you have disk systems or spheroidal systems. And also, I mean, as Kareem showed in his summary plot, at least we've been looking at angular momentum content in the fire simulations, and you go down a factor of 10 in galaxy mass below L star, and those galaxies have substantially lower spin parameter of the stars or all of the baryons with respect to the halo. So it's not even obvious to me that thinking about this in terms of a classical spin sense it has much.
I agree. My goal was not to say that this model necessarily is the correct one. My goal was to say that there are definitely complications which suggest that it's not the whole story,
yeah.
The simple picture. I think it's easy to look at this, and they say, well, we know what's going on. And I don't think we know what's going on quite yet.
Agree.
Go have coffee, people.